For the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. Today, a conversation with a legend, Joe De Leon Hernandez, known as Little Joe, the king of brown sound and leader of one of the most popular Tejano groups in music history, Little Joe y La Familia. Little Joe has helped pioneer Tejano music, which is a mix of traditional norteño, country, blues, and rock. And he is simply one of the most prominent figures in the tradition today. Joining his cousin's band when he was just 13, Joe has been performing around the world for almost 70 years. And he's recorded 70 albums. He's been nominated for a Grammy 11 times, and he's won 5. The first in 1992, the last one in 2020, a testament not just to his longevity, but his continuing significance in the music. A self-described shy kid, Little Joe remains one of music's great dynamic performers. In fact, all agree his power as a live performer is unmatched, and his concerts are a cross between family reunions and cultural events. Little Joe is also known for his activism, supporting many causes through his music, including the United Farm Workers, Farm Aid, and the Diabetes Educational Campaign Fund. In fact, his song, Las Nubes, was adopted by the United Farm Workers as their official marching song, and it became an anthem for the Chicano movement. Little Joe has won hundreds of awards, including the Texas Governor's Award and the Texas State Artist of the Year. And now he can count himself as a National Heritage Fellow, which is the nation's highest honor in folk and traditional arts. I had the pleasure of speaking with Little Joe over the summer, and fittingly, you will occasionally hear the sounds of children in the background. Here's our conversation. Well, first, Little Joe Hernandez, many congratulations on being named a National Heritage Fellow.
Well, thank you so very, very much. I don't know that I'm deserving, but I will sure accept it.
Well, listen, I really want to go back to the beginning because I think your upbringing is so important to who you are now and to the music that you make. So tell me about your parents and your upbringing, where you were brought up.
Well, I was born and raised here in Temple, where I still reside now. I was the first of my family's siblings to be born in town, and I'm seventh of 13. All my other siblings were born out in the boondocks where my dad worked on a plantation, did the sharecropping work. And in 1939, he moved to Temple. He had befriended a family here in Temple named Hernandez as well. And when he moved his family here, really homeless, so Mr. Hernandez, who became his compadre, let my dad and mom and the kids stay in his car garage, which was a three-wall dirt floor car garage. And that's where I was born in 1940. This is where I grew up. Of course, I've been on the road for nearly 62 years. Music's taken me different parts of the world, but this has been my home ever since I was born.
Joe, your family has such a deep-rooted musical heritage. What music were they playing at home? Your father was a singer, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He wrote songs. He was a composer. He played different instruments. Guitar was one of the main instruments. His mom, my grandmother, Luisa, was musically schooled. And she played piano, and I think she even gave lessons in Mexico before they moved to Texas. So all her children, my uncles and aunts, they were all musically talented. My dad's three brothers played guitar, sang, and wrote songs as well. And 2-3 of my dad's sisters sang. So it was a very, very musical family.
Joe, what music were you listening to when you were growing up? What were the sounds you were surrounded by?
So the music I heard was the music that my older brothers and sisters bought records and brought home, or my friends' family, the records they bought. All the kids that I grew up with were black kids, and music from the 40s and the 50s, the big band, the swing, the jazz. And what I heard on the radio, of course, in this part of Texas was really all just country western music. There was one station where there was a morning radio program that played Spanish language music, and I would get to hear it because my dad would get up at 4:30 in the morning to go to work, and the program would come on about that time, 4:35 in the morning. So I'd get to listen to Mexican music for those 30 minutes. And then, of course, my dad and his friends, his compadres and his brothers, there was always music in my home, in my dad's house. And so I would get to listen to some beautiful songs that I just never forgot. And after all these years, and I was lucky to learn them at such an early stage and record them later in life, and have such great response and really hits for my market. And it was just guitars all over the place. And like I said, music into the wee hours of the night. And it was just, for me, it was just really incredible time for me.
How would you define Tejano music?
Tejano, I guess, depends. The description of Tejano depends on whom you ask. Before it was called Tejano music, the only time I remember in the beginning that I heard Tejano was when I would travel to California and the radio stations would say, "Ahí vienen los Tejanos, here come the Tejanos with their music." And so they call it Música Tejana because we would actually exporting music from Texas to California. But when we actually took my music to the major labels and they coined it Tejano music, but before that, my music, I always called it Música Chicana because Mexican-American music in two languages, you know. So Tejano music got an explosion from what the major labels did. They cast their nets and brought in everybody in and merged it with Norteño somewhat. But it, like I said, it depends on who you ask about Tejano music. My music is from old school. Because of the time and when and where I was born, that influenced my music very much so. My preference is jazz, but I'm not good at any one genre or style, so I mix it. I'm happy to say that I found a mix that works for me. That's what my show's about, a little bit of everything that that I heard as a kid. There's country, western, rock and roll, blues, jazz, and of course the Mexican songs. I take the Mexican songs and I have a blues feel to it. So that makes it completely different from the mariachi style. And it just gives it a different flavor because that's how I feel it, in a blues feel. I've been lucky that that's worked for me.
Well, it's so interesting. It's like a gumbo in some ways.
Indeed.
But it's so rooted in Chicano music at the same time. I mean, those roots are really deep there. Your music is also a cultural experience, even as it expands the music of that culture.
I agree very much, Chicano, because that's, you know, where I come from, that's surrounded by the Mexican-American culture. The American culture, of course, the country western music, the black, the rhythm and blues, the rock and roll, who everybody in the 50s wanted to be rock and rollers. But coming from my dad's family and the music I heard as a kid, the songs, I just found a way to produce some arrangement and apply those feels. That some of my music, you can hear the jazz. Since I'm not school taught, so I hear the music they want to produce. So I always needed someone to arrange it for me. I can't read or write music. Sometimes it's frustrating, but I've been fortunate to always have someone to arrange the music the way I want. I did play some guitar when I was a kid, so I did learn something about music, the chords and the notes, but I fired myself when I knew that I couldn't keep up with my band, so I got me a real guitar.
You described yourself as a very shy boy when you were young, but you were also, 13 when you joined your cousin's band, David Coronado and the Latinaires? What propelled you to do that, being as shy as you were?
Well, I was drafted. There were two other kids my age, David, my cousin, was maybe 3-4 years older than he may have been, 16, 17, when he put the band together. And they recruited me as a guitarist, which I didn't know how to play guitar, but David was such a talented musician, and he played guitar and was teaching me chords. And of course, my dad gave me some lessons. And then as I got older, and the black bands that were here from Temple, they were playing rock and roll, and they were playing blues and jazz. I got some lessons, so I learned a little bit more about what I was doing with the guitar. So took a couple of years of David putting the band together, but I was really shy, and it was okay at rehearsals. But when we had to perform in front of people, it was really, really hard for me to get in front of an audience. But in 1955, when I got paid $5 for playing what used to be called sock hops, which was just school dance, high school dance, it just blew my mind that I could actually make money, because I had to pick 500 pounds, a penny a pound of cotton, to make $5. And at that time as well, in 1955, my dad was incarcerated and I had 6 siblings at home. So $5 went an incredible long ways. And as shy as I was, I would sometimes throw up before getting on stage. And I didn't want to sing. I just wanted to play guitar. I wanted to be a jazz guitarist. And like I said, when I found out that was not going to happen, they fired me. It was really difficult for me to get in front of an audience. But necessity makes you do some incredible things. You know, you can overcome a lot of obstacles when necessity calls. I guess I'm still a shy person because I talk a lot, maybe to disguise it. But and then I got the rhythm of it. I sometimes look at the pictures of the Latinaires, the original 4 kids, and say, well, those were 4 little kids with big dreams. Of course, I've been on the road for nearly 62 years. I've been touring. And I remember thinking, I'm going to play music till I'm an old man of 35, and I'm going to have $15,000 in the bank, and I'm going to retire from music. Well, the 35 came and went a little more than twice, and I'm still working on the 15,000, though.
Well, when David moved across the country, you took over the band and became the lead singer. So from shy boy to front man, and it became Little Joe and the Latinaires.
Yes. Well, David actually had me playing the guitar as well as singing, and said, you know, your dad, your aunts, everybody in your family sings, so you should be singing too. They encouraged me, and I started singing, and I love singing. I just couldn't do it in front of a crowd, in front of an audience. And in 1959, David got a call, and he moved to Walla Walla, Washington, and joined with Frank Zappa, because he was a really advanced musician. So there were 3 kids. And then there were 3, drums, saxophone, and guitar. And I would sing Lloyd Price's songs, Just Because, Stagger Lee, and all those rock and roll tunes. But I would always revert back to the songs that I heard as a kid from my dad, and other songs that other groups were recording. I would do things my way, and they worked, you know. And I've got awful timing, but nobody said anything. So I just continued doing what I was doing, offbeat, off tempo, but in tune. And, you know, Josephine, I've learned something after all these years. I'm 83 and I started when I was 13. That would make it, what, 70 years? After 70 years, I've realized that, one, I'm very blessed. I'm a very lucky person. I'm very fortunate to have been born into the family that I was born into. But if people like you, they accept you, you know that there's a lot of one-time hit artists. They have a big hit and then they disappear because the song was a hit, not the artist. I'd like to think that I've been around because people like. I think more importantly, they feel what I do, because that's what music is to me. It's our soul. It's who we are. It's our spirit. And we all have a soul and a spirit, and music connects that. It's an incredible art, you know. It's the only art that makes a little 9-10 month baby move and shake around, and or a 90-year-old person want to still get up and dance. And, you know, the music moves, it touches the soul. Of course, you know, our sculptures and writers and painters, and it's all beautiful, great art. But music, it's the feel. And I believe that I've been able to share that feeling, that soul with the audience. And they supply the energy that drives me. And it's incredible to see young and old people, men and women, in the audience cry with happiness, with sorrow, with the memories of, I guess, people live in their lives. It's so moving that sometimes it brings me to tears while I'm singing as well. It's just magic. And when I'm in that realm, and as the band is, everybody's just in a circle, I feel so free of everything. And I believe that I convey that to the audience. It's such an incredible freedom to be alive and to be sharing, you know. And it's so contagious. You know, you see 2,000-3,000 people in a room and that feeling is there. It's just magic. I have no other way of expressing it.
I think magic is a good word for the music that you make. So the band became Little Joe and the Latin Airs, and your brother Jesse joined the band.
Yes, after David left, and there were three, and my brother Jesse was such a great talent. He played bass, self-taught, played piano and guitar, self-taught. He was younger than I, 3 years younger than I. I was working at a factory and got him a job there. And then one day he says, I'm not doing both day work and music. I'm going to do music. And he shocked me. I said, you can't quit. And, you know, I already had the band going. He says, oh, yes, I can. So he actually forced my hand to quit my job and really get down to business, booking the band. But he always encouraged me. He foresaw something for me that I didn't have that vision. Of course, when Jesse died in a car accident, he was 20 years old. At his graveside, I just promised that I would stay with it and I would take the music, that I would go to the top with it. And of course, different strokes for different folks. What is the top, you know? But when I did a concert in San Antonio, a couple of nights with the San Antonio Symphony, my band and a mariachi group, and it's like 122 pieces when the show would come to a finale and the dancers would come out and the band, the mariachi and the orchestra. It was the 54th anniversary of my brother's death, and I told the story and everybody just broke down along with me. Everybody was crying. But even when I won the first Grammy, it was attributed to Jesse. And one of my older brothers told me, look, Joe, that's the highest award you can get from your peers. You feel you promise. But for me, when I did those shows with the symphony, because I love the symphony, and I thought, this is the pinnacle. And I thought of Jesse, and I thought, you know what, Jesse? I finally got to the top. He's always with me.
Yeah. Well, Joe, a big change occurred when you moved to the Bay Area. This is back in 1970, I think. Why did you make that move to California, and what did you discover out there culturally, musically, politically?
Well, again, Jesse always wanted to go to California when we were kids. And I finally went to California. It's probably 66. I started touring to California in the late 60s, early 70s. I would hang around the Bay Area where it was all happening. Los Angeles as well, but the music scene in San Francisco and in the Bay Area was incredible. People, musicians from all over the world converging there, and all kinds of music, but the Latin thing was really heavy. It was before Carlos Santana or Malo. I went to some of the rehearsals, and that scene was just breaking out, but the Latin jazz was so heavy in the scene. And I have a friend from Houston, a jazz player, Luis Gasca, who had been working with a lot of those groups, and he was able to get me booked on some of those shows that I opened up for different artists, the jazz, salsa. It was just incredible. And then the farm workers movement, a friend, Jim Castle, was producing fundraising concerts for La Causa, for Cesar, and he asked me if I would be part of that. And of course, me coming from the fields, of course, I mean, you know, that's me. I always say I'm a cotton picker and do music on the side. But I got involved and just started learning more about myself, about my roots, about who my family and my culture, my heritage. Of course, the political side of it was there as well. You know, all the marching and protests and everything that was happening, the Chicano movement. And I had already gotten a feel for it from the civil rights, because it seemed like I always had black kids in the band, and got to sleep in a lot of parks where we were refused rooms in the hotels, the motels, and the restaurants. So to me, that was all part of my bringing up, all the segregation and discrimination, racism. It was funny because music kind of got me through those things, you know. I knew I was allowed in places and services that others weren't because of the music. So when I got to California, that was the key. Not only did I want to change the music or improve on it, I wanted to change the name Latin Airs to La Familia, and I did. And it took me quite a while to settle on that name, but then I thought, we're all family. It has such a deep meaning, especially for everyone, but la cultura mexicana, la familia es todo.
Well, you go back to Texas and to Temple, the place you were raised. Why did you decide to return to Texas, bring your family back from California to Texas?
One, I'm a country boy. I need my space. As a matter of fact, Josephine, across from my office is open fields. There's corn and there's cotton planted there. They alternated every year. And that's what I'm looking at. And then I'm home. I'm in the cotton fields. But I miss that. And I didn't want my kids to grow up in that environment and sitting in a big city, because I thought it's more important that my kids grow up in a less insane place, I guess. Came back to Texas, and here I am.
Well, we talked about your music being this incredibly rich gumbo of Latinissimo, but with echoes of jazz, blues, country, R&B, and as we said, this language that you really expanded. But with record companies and to distribute your music, was there pressure on you to go mainstream and go commercial and sort of step back from the Chicano roots of your music?
I had an opportunity, I guess, to give that a shot, or a couple of 2-3 opportunities, but to change my music and I had to go with a major label. Capitol Records offered me a contract, but I read the first paragraph where they were going to own and control, and I had just started my first record company, Buena Suerte, in 1968, and I thought, no, that's not what I want to do. I had an opportunity with my dear friend, Huey Moe, who made a lot of groups happen. Again, I had just started my company, and the company wasn't just for me, but it was for all the bands, my friends here in Texas that had no outlet, because back then, all the music, Spanish language music, was imported from South America or Mexico. We had no record companies in Texas to record us, to record some language music. I know and understand this is a specialized market, and it's not mainstream, but the numbers are there, you know. But for me, starting my own record company, my own record label, which meant getting the music together, taking it to the band, rehearsing it, recording it, then manufacturing, and then distributing and promoting. I did all that. I learned how to do that and owning it. And everything would go well till it come to collecting. Whoops. You know, people bought the product but didn't pay me. That was a learning experience as well. But again, still today, it's like I had to promote a lot of my shows in California, like the Hollywood Palladium. I had to promote that myself, but I had my records being played in the number one Cali station in LA. So it was easy for me to promote my shows. I had 3-4 records at a time on the top 10. It was just really happening. But it's a specialized market. The big agencies don't understand a quinceañera or, you know, baptismal party, or, you know, they don't know how to book those shows, and they don't, you know, and I understand that. So I've always stayed independent, even when I joined the major labels. It was a great experience and great friendships, but they didn't really know or understand the market. They had no idea, the major labels, the numbers that could be sold, the Latin side of the major labels. I worked with them and then decided to stay independent, as I have been. It's just worked for me, you know. Like I said, not knowing exactly what I'm doing, but having a gut feeling and not afraid to run with it has paid off for me.
You are a multilinguist, musically, as we said. And in terms of actual language, the songs move easily from English to Spanish, although most of your songs are in Spanish. I wonder, how do you decide when you write a song which language you're going to sing it in?
I actually write the songs in English and translate to Spanish, or vice versa. Of course, because of the market and not being mainstream, most of all my recordings, I guess, 75% are in Spanish, if not 80%, because in the old days, radio was so different, you know. You'd show up at a radio station with your record, and they'd interview you and spin the record. Well, corporate took over, and that's not how it works now. And now it's global. I've written the songs in English and then translated, or I've written half English, half Spanish. I find it quite easy translating. And I'm happy to see people that don't speak Spanish, but when they hear a song, they sing it, you know. We cannot let languages get in the way of the soul, the feeling, and the music.
Well, speaking of the soul, the feeling, and the music, you've collaborated with many artists and musicians, often in support of something and promoting cross-cultural understandings. Can you just share some of the most meaningful collaborations have been for you?
Surely, and I owe Willie so much. I did probably a dozen of his farm aides with him. And
Willie Nelson.
Yes, Willie Nelson. I had so much fun, and Willie knows that I'm shy, and I remember when we first started collaborating, at one point he says, "Joe, you just do the best you can, and the hell with the rest. I mean, what else can you do? Don't worry." So that was good advice. And I think about it sometimes when I have to take on something that's kind of a first time or something that I'm, you know, nervous about doing. I said, well, I'll just do my best and what the hell? That's what it's like.
But Joe, 70 albums, 5 Grammy Awards, and yet to a person, they swear. None of that holds a candle to what happens when you perform live, that you are one of the great, great performers. And what happens is also this amazingly rich cultural celebration. So not bad for a shy kid. but I wonder, do you do something to prepare yourself before you go on stage?
Oh, it's called agave.
I think I've heard of that.
And the more the better.
It seems to work brilliantly for you.
Yes, I used to. Well, I still do. I mean, I have to warm up more so than I did before. I had problems with my vocal cords, so I learned to prepare in terms of warming up my vocal cords. And I'm still the shy cotton picker no matter what. That's who I am. So I have a little bit of shyness to deal with, but it's easier because no matter how I screw up, it's like, wait a minute, he's a Grammy winner. I feel that's kind of like a shield to get through. But once it kicks off, the magic happens and the response of the people. I've proven that by playing like a show with Willie in somewhere north of Boston, a Farm Aid, where they wouldn't have known who Little Joe is. You know, the acceptance. So that gives me confidence. To me, that's proof that it's about the music. I play my Spanish songs, you know, and bilingual. And people that had never heard or experienced Little Joe just dive right into it. The Farm Aids, you know, I mean, you're talking about a lot of people out there. And for me to whoop them up. And I would almost always open with the national anthem. And Pootie, Willie's stage manager, he said, that damn Little Joe, he figured out how to get a standing ovation every time. Well, every time I kick off into the, and start with the national anthem, people stand up.
Well, Joe, you have had 11 nominations and won 5 Grammy Awards, the first in 1992 and the last one in 2010. That is a long career trajectory. And you were the first Tejano artist to win a Grammy. What was the experience of winning a Grammy like for you? And did you go to the awards ceremony? And what was it like being there? Just what was the whole thing like?
It was something that I, like I said, I never expected. But I guess that was my brother Jesse's vision. And the first album, the first Grammy was actually under Best Mexican-American Performance. That was before Tejano. So I didn't change my music. The industry changed the title of it. But it was the Best Mexican-American Performance. It was in New York. Vicky Carr and I were sitting together, and she got her a Grammy first. And I go up next and I get my Grammy. Of course, I dedicated it to my brother's memory. And it was just an incredible experience in that sense. But you know, Trafine, with me, it takes time for things to sink in my hard head brain. I didn't get excited about it till later, weeks later. And this NEA award, I understand the meaning of it, and, you know, it takes just a little while for me to, whoa, grasp it. Wow, this is the greatest recognition I could ever get from the arts. So I'm excited. I'm grateful. I'm thankful that I would be chosen to be given such recognition. I appreciate each and every award of all kinds, and I have hundreds of them. And I appreciate them all, but this is for my little brother because I really feel that I fulfilled my promise to him.
More than, I would say.
I got more than I deserve, and I'm totally grateful.
And I'm grateful that you, A, gave me your time today, but more importantly, that you've given so much to all of us for so long, and that you received a National Heritage Award. Thank you.
That I'm still trying to process. How did that happen? But however it did, I'm totally grateful.
Thank you, Joe. I really appreciate it.
Oh, gracias, Josephine. And thank you for being patient.
Oh, no. Are you kidding?
This is good for me, too, because I'm always looking forward. Not a whole lot of time for reflecting. So this is actually good for me. I feel good you let me just brag about myself.
Well, it was wonderful to be on the opposite end of it. Thank you. That was Tejano Le- legend Little Joe Hernandez. Little Joe will join the other 2023 National Heritage Fellows on Thursday, September 28th, and Friday, September 29th in Washington, D.C. And you can too. That's when the NEA will honor the most recent class of Heritage Fellows. And since it's the first in-person Heritage Fellowship event since 2019, we're bringing them together with the 2020, 2021, and 2022 Fellows, for a celebration that explores the legacy and impact of this lifetime honor. For information how you can join the events, either in person or virtually, go to arts.gov/heritage. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts, and then leave us a rating on Apple because it helps other people who love the arts to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.